Section 3, The Crisis Deepens, An American Story. By the 1850s, feelings were running high among Northerners and Southerners over whether slavery should be allowed in new territories. These strong feelings also tore old political parties apart and created new ones. Soon after Lincoln was defeated in his race for senator from Illinois, he wrote to a Springfield friend, "I think I am a Whig, but others say there are not Whigs, and that I am an abolitionist. I now do no more than oppose the extension of slavery. I am not a know-nothing. How could I be? How can anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? As a nation, we began by declaring all men are created equal. We now practically read it, all men are created equal except Negroes. When the know-nothings get control, it will read, all men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. When it comes to this, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty. To Russia, for instance." Quoted in Abraham Lincoln. Birth of the Republican Party. When the Kansas-Nebraska Act repealed the Missouri Compromise, it enraged many people who opposed the extension of slavery. A few of these people resorted to violence, but the effect was just as dramatic on political parties. Both the Whigs and the Democrats were split. In the Whig Party, pro-slavery Southern Whigs and anti-slavery Northern Whigs had long battled for control of their party. With passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, disaster was complete. Every Northern Whig in Congress had voted against the bill, while most Southern Whigs had supported it. "We Whigs of the North," wrote one member from Connecticut, "are unalterably determined never to have even the slightest political correspondence or connection with the Southern Whigs." Anger over the Kansas-Nebraska Act convinced former Whigs, members of the Free Soil Party, and a few anti-slavery Democrats to work together during the congressional elections of 1854. These coalitions took many different names, including the Anti-Nebraska Party, the Fusion Party, the People's Party, and the Independent Party. The most popular name for the new coalition was the Republican Party. Republicans organize. At a convention in Michigan in July 1854, the Republican Party was officially organized. In choosing the same name as Jefferson's original party, the Republicans declared their intention to revive the spirit of the American Revolution. Just as Jefferson had chosen the name because he wanted to prevent the United States from becoming a monarchy, the new Republicans chose their name because they feared that the Southern planters were becoming an aristocracy that controlled the federal government. Republicans did not agree on whether slavery should be abolished in the Southern states, but they did agree that it had to be kept out of the territories. A large majority of Northern voters seemed to agree, enabling the Republicans and the other anti-slavery parties to make great strides in the elections of 1854. The Know-Nothings. At the same time, public anger against the Northern Democrats also enabled the American Party, better known as the Know-Nothings, to make great gains as well, particularly in the Northeast. The American Party was an anti-Catholic and nativist party. It opposed immigration, particularly Catholic immigration, into the United States. Prejudice and fear that immigrants would take away jobs enabled the Know-Nothings to win many seats in Congress and the state legislatures in 1854. Soon after the election, the Know-Nothings suffered the same fate as the Whigs. Many Know-Nothings had been elected from the Upper South, particularly Maryland, Tennessee, and Kentucky. They quickly split with Know-Nothings from the North over their support for the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Furthermore, the violence in Kansas and the beating of Charles Sumner made slavery a far more important issue to most Americans than immigration. Eventually, the Republican Party absorbed the Northern Know-Nothings. Reading check. Examining. What events led to the founding of the Republican Party? The election of 1856. To gain the widest possible support in the 1856 campaign, the Republicans nominated John C. Fremont, a famous Western explorer nicknamed the Pathfinder. Fremont had spoken in favor of Kansas becoming a free state. He had little political experience, but also no embarrassing record to defend. The Democrats nominated James Buchanan. Buchanan had served in Congress for 20 years and had been the American ambassador to Russia and then to Great Britain. He had been in Great Britain during the debate over the Kansas-Nebraska Act and had not taken a stand on the issue, but his record in Congress showed that he believed the best way to save the Union was to make concessions to the South. The American Party tried to reunite its Northern and Southern members at its convention. But most of the northern delegates walked out when the party refused to call for the repeal of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. The rest of the convention then chose former President Millard Fillmore to represent the American Party, hoping to attract the vote of former Whigs. The campaign was really two separate contests, Buchanan against Fremont in the north and Buchanan against Fillmore in the south. Buchanan had solid support in the south and only needed his home state of Pennsylvania and one other to win the presidency. Democrats campaigned on the idea that only Buchanan could save the Union and that the election of Fremont would cause the South to secede. When the votes were counted, Buchanan had won. Reading check. Identifying. What political party and candidate won the presidency in 1856? Sectional divisions grow. Despite Buchanan's determination to adopt policies that would calm the growing sectional strife in the country, a series of events helped drive Americans in the North and South even further apart. The Dred Scott decision. In his March 1857 inaugural address, James Buchanan suggested that the nation let the Supreme Court decide the question of slavery in the territories. Most people who listened to the address did not know that Buchanan had contacted members of the Supreme Court and therefore knew that a decision was imminent. Many Southern members of Congress had quietly pressured the Supreme Court justices to issue a ruling on slavery in the territories. They expected the Southern majority on the court to rule in favor of the South. They were not disappointed. 2 days after the inauguration, the court released its opinion in the case of Dred Scott v. Sanford. Dred Scott was an enslaved man whose Missouri slaveholder had taken him to live in free territory before returning to Missouri. Assisted by abolitionists, Scott sued to end his slavery, arguing that the time he had spent in free territory meant he was free. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. On March 6, 1857, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney delivered the majority opinion in the case. Taney ruled against Scott because he claimed African Americans were not citizens and therefore could not sue in the courts. Taney then addressed the Missouri Compromise's ban on slavery in territory north of Missouri's southern border. It is the opinion of the court that the act of Congress, which prohibited a citizen from holding and owning enslaved persons in the territory of the United States north of the line therein mentioned, is not warranted by the Constitution and is therefore void. From Dred Scott v. Sanford. Instead of removing the issue of slavery in the territories from politics, the Dred Scott decision itself became a political issue that further intensified the sectional conflict. The Supreme Court had said that federal government could not prohibit slavery in the territories. Free soil, one of the basic ideas uniting Republicans, was unconstitutional. Democrats cheered the decision, but Republicans condemned it and claimed it was not binding. Instead, they argued that it was an obiter dictum, an incidental opinion not called for by the circumstances of the case. Southerners, on the other hand, called on Northerners to obey the decision if they wanted the South to remain in the Union. Many African Americans, among them Philadelphia activist Robert Purvis, publicly declared contempt for any government that could produce such an edict. Mr. Chairman, look at the facts. Here in a country with a sublimity of impudence that knows no parallel, setting itself up before the world as a free country, a land of liberty, the land of the free and the home of the brave, the freest country in all the world, and yet here are millions of men and women bought and sold, whipped, manacled, killed all the day long. Quoted in Witness for Freedom. Kansas's Lecompton Constitution. Frustration with the government also fueled the conflict between anti-slavery and pro-slavery forces in Bleeding Kansas. Hoping to end the troubles there, President Buchanan urged the territory to apply for statehood. The pro-slavery legislature scheduled an election for delegates to a constitutional convention, but anti-slavery Kansans boycotted it, claiming it was rigged. The resulting constitution, drafted in the town of Lecompton in 1857, legalized slavery in the territory. Each side then held its own referendum, or popular vote, on the constitution. Anti-slavery forces voted down the constitution, pro-slavery forces approved it. Buchanan accepted the pro-slavery vote and asked Congress to admit Kansas as a slave state. The Senate quickly voted to accept the Lecompton Constitution, but the House of Representatives blocked it. Many members of Congress became so angry during the debates that fistfights broke out. Southern leaders were stunned when even Stephen Douglas of Illinois refused to support them. Many had hoped that Douglas, a Northern leader and possible future president, understood the South's concerns and would make the compromise necessary to keep the South in the Union. Finally, to get the votes they needed, President Buchanan and Southern leaders in Congress agreed to allow another referendum in Kansas on the Constitution. Southern leaders expected to win this referendum. If the settlers in Kansas rejected the Lecompton Constitution, they would delay statehood for Kansas for at least 2 more years. Despite these conditions, the settlers in Kansas voted overwhelmingly in 1858 to reject the Lecompton Constitution. They did not want slavery in their state. As a result, Kansas did not become a state until 1861. Reading check. Summarizing. Why did Dred Scott sue the slaveholder who held him? Lincoln and Douglas. In 1858, Illinois Republicans chose a relative unknown named Abraham Lincoln to run for the Senate against the Democratic incumbent, Stephen A. Douglas. Lincoln launched his campaign in June with a memorable speech in which he declared, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other." Quoted in The Civil War, an Illustrated History. The nationally prominent Douglas, a short, stocky man nicknamed the Little Giant, regularly drew large crowds on the campaign trail. Seeking to overcome Douglas's fame, Lincoln proposed a series of debates between the candidates, which would expose him to larger audiences than he could attract on his own. Douglas confidently accepted. Born on the Kentucky frontier and raised in Indiana, Lincoln had experienced little more than small-town life. A storekeeper, millhand, and rail splitter during his youth, he went on to study and practice law. Later, he served in the Illinois State Legislature and for a single term in the U.S. House of Representatives as a member of the Whig Party. Despite this modest background, Lincoln proved himself a gifted debater. Both witty and logical, he regularly illuminated his points with quotations from Scripture or appealing homespun stories from everyday life. Although not an abolitionist, Lincoln believed slavery to be morally wrong and opposed its spread into Western territories. Douglas, by contrast, supported popular sovereignty. During a debate in Freeport, Lincoln asked Douglas if the people of a territory could legally exclude slavery before achieving statehood. If Douglas said yes, he would appear to be supporting popular sovereignty and opposing the Dred Scott ruling, which would cost him Southern support. If he said no, it would make him seem as if he had abandoned popular sovereignty, the principle on which he had built his national following. Douglas tried to avoid the dilemma, formulating an answer that became known as the Freeport Doctrine. He replied that he accepted the Dred Scott ruling, but he argued that people could still keep slavery out by refusing to pass the laws needed to regulate and enforce it. "Slavery cannot exist anywhere," said Douglas, "unless it is supported by local police regulations." Douglas's response pleased Illinois voters but angered Southerners. Lincoln also attacked Douglas's claim that he cared not whether Kansans voted for or against slavery. Denouncing the modern democratic idea that slavery is as good as freedom, Lincoln called on voters to elect Republicans whose hearts are in the work, who do care for the result. Has anything ever threatened the existence of this Union, save and except this very institution of slavery? What is it that we hold most dear among us? Our own liberty and prosperity. What has ever threatened our liberty and prosperity, save and except this institution of slavery? If this is true, how do you propose to improve the condition of things by enlarging slavery, by spreading it out and making it bigger? You may have a wen, a sore, or a cancer upon your person and not be able to cut it out lest you bleed to death, but surely it is no way to cure it to engraft it and spread it over your whole body. That is no proper way of treating what you regard a wrong. Quoted in The Civil War, Opposing Viewpoints. Douglas won the election, but Lincoln did not come away empty-handed. He had seized the opportunity in the debates to make clear the principles of the Republican Party. He had also established a national reputation for himself as a man of clear, insightful thinking who could argue with force and eloquence. Within a year, however, national attention shifted to another figure, a man who opposed slavery not with well-crafted phrases, but with a gun. Reading check. Examining. What were the positions of Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln on slavery? John Brown's raid. John Brown was a fervent abolitionist who believed, as one minister who knew him in Kansas said, that God had raised him up on purpose to break the jaws of the wicked.
In 1859, he developed a plan to seize the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, today in West Virginia, free and arm the enslaved people of the neighborhood, and begin an insurrection or rebellion against slaveholders. On the night of October 16, 1859, Brown and 18 followers seized the arsenal. To the terrified night watchman, he announced, "I have possession now of the United States Armory, and if the citizens interfere with me, I must only burn the town and have blood." Soon, however, Brown was facing a contingent of U.S. Marines rushed to Harper's Ferry from Washington, D.C., under the command of Colonel Robert E. Lee. Just 36 hours after it had begun, Brown's attempt to start a slave insurrection ended with his capture. A Virginia court tried and convicted him and sentenced him to death. In his last words to the court, Brown, repenting nothing, declared, "I believe that to have interfered as I have done, as I have always freely admitted I have done in behalf of God's despised poor, I did no wrong, but right. Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and mingle my blood with the blood of millions in this slave country whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I say, let it be done." Quoted in John Brown, 1800 to 1859. On December 2nd, the day of his execution, Brown handed one of his jailers a prophetic note. "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed it might be done." Many Northerners viewed Brown as a martyr in a noble cause. The execution, Henry David Thoreau predicted, would strengthen abolitionist feeling in the North. "He is not old Brown any longer," Thoreau declared. "He is an angel of light." For most Southerners, however, Brown's raid offered all the proof they needed, that Northerners were actively plotting the murder of slaveholders. "Defend yourselves," cried Georgia Senator Robert Toombs. "The enemy is at your door." Reading check. Evaluating. In what ways might a Northerner and a Southerner view John Brown's action differently? American literature. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery in Maryland in 1818. During the course of his incredible life, he escaped from slavery and eventually became renowned for eloquent lectures and writings for the causes of abolition and liberty. One of his most famous works is his autobiography about growing up under the shadow of slavery. In the following excerpt, Douglass is around 8 years old, and Mrs. Auld, the wife of his slaveholder, has begun to teach him to read. Mr. Auld discovers what his wife has been doing, and his reaction causes young Frederick to decide to learn to read on his own, no matter what. From Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, by Frederick Douglass. "Now," said Mr. Auld, "if you teach that boy how to read, there would be no keeping him. It would forever unfit him to be a slave. He would at once become unmanageable and of no value to his master. As to himself, it could do him no good, but a great deal of harm. It would make him discontented and unhappy." These words sank deep into my heart, stirred up sentiments within that lay slumbering, and called into existence an entirely new train of thought. It was a new and special revelation, explaining dark and mysterious things with which my youthful understanding had struggled, but struggled in vain. From that moment I understood the pathway from slavery to freedom. It was just what I wanted, and I got it at a time when I least expected it. Whilst I was saddened by the thought of losing the aid of my kind mistress, I was gladdened by the invaluable instruction which, by the merest accident, I had gained from my master. Though conscious of the difficulty of learning without a teacher, I set out with high hope and a fixed purpose, at whatever cost of trouble, to learn to read. That which to Mr. Auld was a great evil, to be carefully shunned, was to me a great good, to be diligently sought. And the argument which he so warmly urged against my learning to read only served to inspire me with a desire and determination to learn. In learning to read, I owe almost as much to the bitter opposition of my master as to the kindly aid of my mistress. I acknowledge the benefit of both.